Welcome to the Fresh Heart Project. We share evidence-based tools to refocus your energy and optimize your health without judgment and with compassion. I am really excited to launch the new season with a special episode on insomnia. We were incredibly lucky to be able to sit down with Dr. Jade Wu, a sleep medicine specialist based at Duke University's School of Medicine in North Carolina. She generously took time out of her day to share some invaluable insights into insomnia, as well as correcting some commonly held assumptions on sleep habits and how we can all feel better. If insomnia is something that you or your loved ones experience, then this is the episode for you. You're guaranteed to come away with actionable tips that you can start using straight away. Enjoy the interview. So guys, I am delighted to welcome Dr. Jade Wu to the Fresh Heart Project. Jade is a board-certified behavioral sleep medicine specialist and sleep researcher at Duke University School of Medicine. Her current research focuses on treating sleep disorders and chronic illness. I was first introduced to Jade when I listened to her award-winning podcast, The Savvy Psychologist. It's brilliant. What struck me most is she has a really non-judgmental approach, which is grounded in evidence and delivered with such compassion. I knew I had to have her on the show. I'm not alone. She's a frequent guest on popular American radio and contributes to many publications, including the Huffington Post, Men's Health, and Slate. She is here today to talk about insomnia, a topic that is so incredibly important, especially right now as we're navigating through such uncertain times. Welcome, Jade. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Zareen. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'm going to start by asking you about when your interest in sleep medicine developed, because for me, I was thrown into a PhD and I realized it's a fascinating field and we didn't really learn much about it at medical school. So talk me through how you entered this field, because it is quite niche, isn't it? How did you get an interest in sleep?
It's kind of funny because I grew up kind of knowing about sleep research. My father worked for the Chinese equivalent of NASA. And so he actually did research on astronauts and sleep. So when I was a little kid, I would sometimes go to the sleep lab with him and sort of see him doing fun, cool, exciting, sciencey things with sleep. And I said, I want to be a sleep researcher when I was like 5 years old. And then of course took a lot of meandering turns and didn't want to be a scientist at all for a while. But eventually every career and every academic decision I made took me back closer and closer to my original plan. And here I am doing sleep health research, not with astronauts, but, you know, close enough.
That's amazing. It's wonderful how he inspired you. And, you know, sometimes when you see your parents as kids, you think, wow, that's amazing. And then that kind of passion turns into something else. But it's such a lovely story that you actually did follow in his footsteps. He must be very proud. So my first question is really about the duration of sleep, because there's so much information out there, isn't there? You must sleep this long because otherwise, you know, you'll have a heart attack or you'll do this or you'll die young. I feel like there's quite a lot of fear mongering. And I get terrified reading some of it as well. And so what I'd like to ask you first of all is there a, you know, how much sleep do you really need? And is 8 hours really the holy grail?
That's such a fantastic question. And I think that's one of the top questions on people's minds when they wonder about their sleep. And I think this 8 hour holy grail that you're talking about is a pretty common myth. And there are people who do need 8 hours of sleep. There's no doubt about that. But there's a lot of difference and variation between people. You might need 7 hours. I might need 9 hours. Somebody else might need 6 hours. And there's just really no easy way to tell exactly how much sleep we need. So saying, you know, you should get 8 hours of sleep is kind of like saying you should drink 8 glasses of water a day. Well, It depends a little bit, right? Like if you live in the desert, you probably need more. If you live in the rainforest, maybe less. If you're LeBron James, or David Beckham during training, you might need more, but someone who works in an office, maybe less. So that works for sleep too. It depends on where you live, how old you are, your lifestyle, and lots of other factors. So I think we tend to think of sleep as something we need to put in a box or something we need to control or wrestle into shape. But really, our brains know best. Our brains know exactly how much sleep we need. And that might be different from night to night, season to season. And it certainly changes over the course of our own lifetime, too. So trying to hold really rigidly onto that one number of what we think we need might spell trouble.
Jade, that's so helpful because I feel like there's a lot of stress out there when people think, oh, I haven't gotten my X number of hours of sleep in. And I think that adds to a lot of the anxiety, doesn't it, about, sleep and getting enough sleep.
Yes, and I think it's especially a problem for people who have insomnia because insomnia, a big part of it is just having a lot of anxiety about sleep. So someone with insomnia might end up in a vicious cycle where the less they feel like they're sleeping well, the more they think they're sleep deprived, the more anxious they get, and then the more anxious they get, the harder it is to sleep. So then we get into this vicious cycle. And there's a really interesting other wrench in that equation too, which is that for some reason, people with insomnia tend to have a misperception of sleep. And this is not their fault. It's not that they're exaggerating or they're being dramatic or they're making it up or it's all in their head. That's not what I mean. But we know from scientific research that people who have insomnia actually perceive sleep differently. So, for example, if you have insomnia and I don't, and we're both hooked up to EEG machines, which can read our brain waves and tell if we're sleeping or not, and a lab tech comes and pokes you awake during stage one or stage two sleep, which are light stages of sleep, and they ask you, well, what was happening, Zareen? You as the person with insomnia, you would say, well, I've just been tossing and turning. I've been trying to fall asleep and I can't. Whereas during the exact same stages of sleep, stage one and stage two, if that lab tech were to poke me awake, I would say, oh, I guess I must have drifted off. So there's a real difference in the way that the brain processes and perceives sleep for people with insomnia. So then that adds another layer of complication because they might be getting, say, 6.5 hours of sleep, but they feel like they're only getting five. So then that makes them even more anxious because now they're 3 hours away from their goal of 8 hours instead of an hour and a half. So then they get more anxious and then it's harder to sleep and more insomnia, more misperception. And we can get into this really unfortunate, vicious cycle.
That's so interesting, Jade. And I agree with you. I think there is a real vicious cycle, isn't there? And I think sleep changes as you get older, doesn't it? Naturally, it changes because I have a lot of patients who get really worried that their sleep all of a sudden has kind of really changed from how they were when they were younger. And that does cause an extra amount of stress. Can you talk us through how sleep does change as you get older?
Yeah, sleep changes in a few ways when we get older. There is a biological side to it where sleep just naturally changes shape and size. So we tend to sleep a little bit less as we get older. And also the proportions of different types of sleep change too. We tend to have a little bit less deep sleep. And that's okay because we're not going through puberty anymore. We're not, running around doing all sorts of things the way we were doing when, in our 20s. And we have a little bit more wakefulness and more frequent wakefulness during the night. So the shape and size of sleep tends to change. And I think this causes a lot of anxiety because people are thinking, well, don't I need deep sleep? Don't I need 8 hours of sleep? How come it's different now? Well, one of the reasons it's different is because our needs are different when we're older. If you think about our ancestors living on the savannah, it's the young folks who are doing the hunting and the gathering, right? The older ones are not so much. They're having less physical activity. And maybe the difference is not quite as extreme nowadays, but there is some change. As we get older, we're probably a little less physically active. When we retire, that might introduce another big change in the rhythms of our lives, the amount of light exposure we have, the amount of hustle and bustle in our lives. So there's a biological change, but there's also the behavioral change too, and the social change. So a big component is something that we cannot help. And then there's a component that maybe we can. So I do encourage my older patients, especially as they're negotiating that change into retirement, to keep up with their social activities and to pick up new hobbies or stay mentally active and socially active, physically active. And all of these things can help to maintain a good relationship with sleep.
That's wonderful advice. And it's certainly, you know, I'm going to take that forward and give that to my patients, my older patients as well. So thank you, Jade. And sleep changes for women as well, doesn't it? Particularly around the menopause, because I get a lot of, patients, friends, colleagues saying, oh, you know, I keep waking up, or I keep, you know, I'm just not getting as much sleep. And that as well becomes a form of stress. So talk us through a little bit about women in particular and the menopause and what happens around that time.
Sure. Women are more likely to have insomnia than men in general at every life stage. And menopause, and also pregnancy and postpartum, by the way, too, are some of the most common times for women to develop insomnia. And again, there's a few reasons, a few different stars aligning to cause that sleep disruption. One is that biological hormonal change. So as there are big hormonal fluctuations in these reproductive changes, there's, you know, changes in progesterone, estrogen, and in the case of postpartum and pregnancy, there might be changes in prolactin. With all of these changes, there are sleep changes that go along with that. Not all of them bad. So for example, prolactin actually increases deep sleep. So breastfeeding is actually protective for your sleep, just as an FYI. But during menopause, that there tends not to be a lot of sleep protective things happening, unfortunately. So some of these hormonal changes are causing wild swings in temperature, which are obviously very uncomfortable, these hot flashes that happen during the day and night. There might be other changes like fatigue. And fatigue can also not only lead to us feeling unsatisfied with our sleep, because during the day when we feel tired, we think, oh, that must be because my sleep was really bad. It also makes us do behaviors like rest more, or maybe try to take a nap in the middle of the day, or we're less motivated to go and be physically active and socially active, which then feeds back into having less of a sleep drive, less physical activity. And so that ends up disrupting our sleep as well. So there's, again, a little bit of a vicious cycle here. But the good news is that I think menopause doesn't have to be a problem for sleep, or if it is already, it doesn't have to last forever. You know, insomnia can be caused by a million different causes, different triggers, and menopause happens to be one of the more common ones. But no matter what happens with menopause, sleep can go back to normal if you are sort of practicing healthy behaviors around sleep, you're maintaining a good relationship with sleep, and you're not expecting your sleep to stay exactly the same way. So I often counsel people to kind of roll with it, you know, not be too rigid with their expectations, and really listen to their body, listen to how sleepy they actually feel. Because sometimes patients will tell me, I feel like I really shouldn't be waking up 3 or 4 times a night to use the bathroom. Is that okay? There must be something wrong with my sleep. But actually waking up a few times is no big deal. I mean, as long as you're feeling generally able to function and doing well during the day, you're doing great. And so even if your sleep changes, that doesn't mean it's bad. So listen to your body and kind of roll with it.
I think that's such important information. And it's amazing, because we almost start to mistrust our body and mistrust the signals, don't we? Because you think, oh, I should be doing this. I should be getting my 8 hours. I shouldn't be waking in the night. I shouldn't be doing this. And then you stop listening to those signals. So that's such an important message, Jade. I think, you know, listen to those signals. Your body knows what it's doing most of the time. What I now want to sort of segue into is more of the sort of troublesome sleep patterns and to talk a little bit about insomnia, because you have a lot of experience in dealing with insomnia, which is why you're here today and, you know, why we're picking your brains on this really important topic, especially now around the pandemic when people are having real difficulty sleeping. I'm seeing it in my own life with my friends, also with patients. So can you talk about insomnia and just tell us what the definition of insomnia is to start with?
Yes, so insomnia is a sleep disorder where someone has a lot of trouble falling asleep or staying asleep or waking up too early. And this is happening repeatedly, maybe not every night, but most of the time. And it's been happening long enough that we know it's not just one stressful week or one exam or one event that's causing it. It's gotten to a point where it really feels like the insomnia has taken on a life of its own. So that's what we think about when we think about chronic insomnia or insomnia disorder. And so one really interesting thing I think to point out, and an important thing to point out, is that this definition of insomnia does not include a cutoff for how many hours you sleep or how many times you wake up or how long it takes you to fall asleep. There are no hard and fast rules about those numbers. And I really want to emphasize this because insomnia, this is really speaking to the fact that insomnia is a really a subjective disorder. Not to say that it's not real or that it's all in your head, but to say that this is a problem of having a relationship problem with sleep. So it's, you know, you don't automatically qualify for insomnia if you sleep less than 7 hours. Some people who sleep on average 8 hours have insomnia if they're having trouble falling asleep or staying asleep. And there are people who sleep 6 hours who don't have insomnia. So it's really important to understand that important piece about what it is. And insomnia can happen to anybody. It's very common actually for everybody to experience a little bit of short-term insomnia here and there. I think probably you and I have both had a little bit of that at some point, but for insomnia to really carry on a life of its own and to become a chronic thing over months and years and sometimes decades, what really keeps insomnia going are the ways that we think about sleep and the ways that we act around sleep that happen to not be so helpful.
And would you say there are potential triggers that can then lead to insomnia?
There are some triggers that are common sort of triggers for insomnia. Like we talked about menopause being one, pregnancy and postpartum, certainly a big time for sleep disruption, and times of high stress, a job that maybe is very stressful, or switching jobs, or even good stressors like getting married and planning a wedding or having a child or traveling abroad. All sorts of fun things can also lead to a period of sleep disruption. But the main thing to remember here is that even if your sleep is disrupted, no matter what the trigger is that triggered that in the first place, that doesn't automatically cause long-term chronic insomnia. So there are almost as many different triggers for insomnia as there are people with insomnia. But what keeps the insomnia going tends to be pretty universal. There are some major ones.
That's really important information as well. And what I'd like to move on to just before we talk about treatments for insomnia specifically is sleep hygiene, because there's a lot put out about sleep hygiene, a lot put out about on social media about sleep hygiene, about what you should and shouldn't do. So can you just talk us through sleep hygiene, but then as a sort of second point to that, I also want you to just tell us a little bit about how effective it is in insomnia and whether, you know, what you would advise.
Sleep hygiene is a really interesting topic, and it's interesting because it can be a double-edged sword. So it in and of itself is not a good or bad thing. Well, I would say it's more of a good thing. It's not a bad thing. And so sleep hygiene includes recommendations like having a wind down time before bedtime and going to bed at the same time, having a cool room, a comfortable sleeping environment, not too hot, not too cold, you know, not too noisy, not too bright. So things that you can do to improve sleep hygiene include things like you know, not taking your work to bed. So don't take your laptop into bed to answer work emails, and invest in some blackout curtains maybe to keep out the light, or wear earplugs if you live in a noisy neighborhood. And all of these are great pieces of advice, I think, for people who generally have a good relationship with sleep, but could maybe improve the quality of sleep a little bit. It's kind of like maybe your sleep is B plus right now, but you want it to be an A. Sleep hygiene is for you. And I like to think of sleep hygiene as similar to dental hygiene. It's all good stuff, things that you can practice and make a habit of, but do not expect it to cure your cavity once you already have one. Do not expect it to cure your insomnia once you already have insomnia. It's simply not enough, and it's not hitting the right notes when you're trying to use it to cure insomnia. And in fact, for insomnia researchers like me, we actually use sleep hygiene as the control condition in our trials. So when we go to test cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, which is the most evidence-based therapy for insomnia, when we go to do a clinical trial to see how effective that is, the comparison, the placebo condition that we use is sleep hygiene, because we do not expect that to work alone. And the reason is sleep hygiene does not get to the root causes of insomnia. It does not address those perpetuating factors, the things that we already slightly talked about, the things that keep insomnia going in the long run. And in fact, for some people who are very anxious about their sleep and have insomnia, working really hard on perfecting their sleep hygiene can backfire, because then you're just working really hard on sleep. You're buying really expensive mattresses, you're meditating religiously, you know, you're spending a lot of time researching how to improve your sleep hygiene, but all of this effort and attention is then actually really highlighting this sleep problem in your life. It's like holding a magnifying glass up to a problem. So it makes it seem much bigger, makes you more anxious, makes it harder to sleep. So sleep hygiene, that's why it's a double-edged sword.
I love that, because there's also, it's very easy to then blame yourself if you're doing everything right and you're still not sleeping. You're like, well, what am I doing wrong? What else can I do? You know, I've kept my room cool. I've, you know, had this wind down time. There's no screen times. There's no, you know, you're ticking all the boxes. And so it's really important actually to then say, right, I need extra help. This is not going to be solved with, you know, having a bit of a wind down time and a bath before bed. Like, something else needs to happen. Is that where CBT, where cognitive behavioral therapy comes in? What are the tools that you use to actually help treat insomnia?
Absolutely. Cognitive behavioral therapy is the first line treatment for adult insomnia, and it's been demonstrated to be quite effective by a lot of clinical trials. So we're very proud of having this very effective treatment. And in a very short summary, essentially it is addressing the cognitive, which is thoughts, and the behavioral, which is actions that we do that keep insomnia going. So for example, someone who had a bout of short-term insomnia because of a really stressful job, they might have noticed their sleep getting disrupted, and then they got really worried about it. And so they started going to bed really early to try to make up for lost sleep. But if you're going to bed too early and you haven't built enough sleep drive up yet, you're not sleepy enough, then you're not going to fall asleep. And so you end up spending a lot of time tossing and turning and being awake in bed. And all of that time spent in bed is just making you more frustrated, more hopeless about your insomnia. And this whole time you're learning that the bed is a wakeful and frustrating place. So now this whole going to bed early thing is actually backfiring and making insomnia worse. So that's one of the examples of the things that we target in CBTI, cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, where we look at someone's sleep patterns from day to day. We look at how much sleep they're actually able to achieve right now on average. And we try to limit the amount of time they spend in bed to closer to that time, so that we can protect people's time outside of bed to live their life, to build up their sleep drive, to have a healthier relationship with their sleep and their health, and save that time in bed just for sleeping. And that ends up starting a positive cycle of having less anxiety about sleep, more sleep drive. So like a big reset button for the sleep physiology, and a better relationship with sleep.
So Jade, what I get asked a lot is, say for example, someone who's sleeping and wakes up in the middle of the night, and then their mind just starts racing and they can't really put that those racing thoughts to, well, to bed really. They can't, their mind becomes active, they can't get back to sleep, they become really restless, they then start worrying about not sleeping, and it's a bit of a vicious cycle, isn't it? So what's the advice for someone who just wakes up in the middle of the night and can't get back to bed?
Sure. And this is a very common experience, I think, for people with insomnia. And I would start with three things. So the first thing is to ask yourself, what's so bad about being awake? And I think this is a question that often people haven't asked themselves. We just kind of assume that waking up is bad, right? Being awake in the night is bad. We should be sleeping uninterrupted. And that's simply not true. I mean, healthy people wake up between 10 and 16 times a night. And most of those are very brief awakenings that they don't remember, but it's perfectly natural to wake up during the night. Now, it does become a little problematic if you're waking up and can't go back to sleep for a really long time and you're frustrated about it. Of course, that's not a pleasant experience. But sometimes knowing that historically at other times of, you know, the European past and in other cultures, people purposely get up during the night to do chores or to tell stories or just to hang out, to make love, you know, for an hour or two. That was actually a very common thing. So that's where the saying of first sleep versus second sleep came from. So sometimes just knowing that, that it's actually okay to be awake during the night can be helpful. And the second tip I would say is to get out of bed and do something else. And this is something that most people with insomnia have probably heard. However, what they probably haven't heard is that the point of doing this is not that it will help you get back to sleep. Getting up out of bed is not going to make you sleepier necessarily. What it's going to do is prevent you from making the insomnia worse in the long run. Because remember how we talked about the way our brains like to put two and two together. If we spend a lot of time in bed, awake and frustrated and anxious, then we learn that the bed is a frustrating and anxious and awake place. So the more time you do that in bed, the more likely you are to do that in the future. So let's nip that in the bud, or let's at least not add on to it. So get out of bed. If you're going to be awake, you might as well be awake somewhere else. And the third tip I would say is to actually just do something enjoyable. You know, when you get up out of bed, you're not punishing yourself. You know, you don't need to sit there and read the phone book or whatever the modern equivalent of that is, the most boring thing you can find to do. You don't need to do that. You can enjoy a fun book or play a game of solitaire or work on a hobby. You don't have to keep the lights so dim that you can barely see where you're going. It's okay. Having a little light exposure is not going to completely ruin your sleep. I mean, if you can keep it generally orangey dim lights, that would be great, but it's not the end of the world. I would much rather you just go ahead and watch TV and enjoy yourself, rather than be so strict with yourself that you end up being bored and more frustrated about having to get out of bed. So those are the main things I would do. Oh, maybe a bonus one for the people who really feel like their thoughts are racing and they can't shut off their thoughts. One of the reasons that happens is that we don't give enough time to ourselves to introspect and to let our thoughts flow during the day. Our thoughts are a little bit like young children. Like, they just really want our attention. They just really want to tell us something, you know, so they're going around pulling on our sleeves all day saying, pay attention to me, pay attention to me. And if you keep ignoring them and pushing them away all day, don't spend any time on them, then at bedtime or in the middle of the night, suddenly everything's quiet. You have no distractions. Your thoughts are like, oh, this is our time to come out and play. And we've been saving these up all day for you. Let's just go chatter, chatter, chatter. just like, you know, kids would do if you don't pay attention to them all day. So what you could do instead is set aside some time during the day to take a walk, introspect, let your thoughts flow. Or you can even sit down and write down your thoughts, journal a little bit. Doesn't have to be beautiful prose. You're not going to publish poetry out of this. It's okay. Just jot down on a piece of napkin, you know, what's going through your mind. And that's giving some attention to your thoughts so that they're not so desperate to get your attention later on when you're trying to sleep.
That is excellent advice. And I have heard that the journaling really helps. Actually, I haven't tried it myself. And actually, I will try it because I've heard it from so many different people now. I mean, I have a little journal by my bed now. So thank you, Jade. You're definitely helping. I want to also ask about light. Now, there are lots of fancy gadgets out. Sleep is full of fancy gadgets, isn't it? You can get all sorts of things. But in particular, you can get really expensive lamps that sort of slowly wake you up in the morning, or slowly, you know, and sort of touted to help with seasonal affective disorder and help with, you know, resetting your body clock and things. What's your feeling on these, you know, lights? Do they have to be that fancy? Do they have to be that expensive? Or what sort of light in the morning can help you?
Light is a very powerful thing for our health and our sleep. And there's a lot of things that it can do. So I think maybe there are two questions here. One is, how important is light? And two is, do you need gadgets to do those functions? And I'll answer those separately because I think they might be different answers. So light is extremely important. It helps us to set our biological clock. It, as you mentioned, seasonal affective disorder, it can have a big impact on our mood. It's good for our energy, alertness. So light is absolutely crucial. And what we really want in terms of light for our sleep health and mental health is to get lots of bright light during the day and not so much light at night. So the key is actually the contrast between day and night. Sometimes I think people think, oh, I need to just dim lights because lights are stimulating me. They're making me have insomnia. So then they end up dimming things during the day too, or they wear those blue light blocking glasses during the day. I'm like, no. Contrast is the best thing. So brighten up your life during the day, go outside, you know, sit by a window, try to take advantage of sunny days. Absolutely. That's going to help you. And dim your lights at night. So our ancestors did not have broad spectrum light or blue or short wavelength light after sunset. And there's actually research showing that if you mimic that by going camping without any devices, you can actually shift your biological clock. So for people who are night owls who need to function like morning people, but they're just not wired that way, I'm actually one of those people. One good way to reset your clock and become a morning person is to go camping without devices. Now, obviously, that's not always available. We can't do that all the time. So you can try to mimic that a little bit in your life by, you know, making your lights more orange in color and dimmer once the sun sets. But also I would warn that, or I would offer that you don't need to get really fancy and really specific and very algorithmic about this in order to get the benefits of light. Really, it boils down to get more light during the day, try to have less light during the night, but it's not a huge deal if you can't. Like, it's not the end of the world if you watch TV or you're on your Kindle or something after sunset. Not a big deal. The more important thing is to make that contrast. Now, how fancy do the gadgets need to get? They don't need to get that fancy. It can be nice if you have the budget to splurge on one of these morning wake up light alarm things that's really soothing and it plays you music and it looks pretty and, you know, you just like it. By all means, that's fine. That's like getting an extra fancy toothbrush or getting a silk pillow instead of a cotton pillow. That's really nice. But that's not going to fix your insomnia if you have insomnia, and you also don't need it to overcome insomnia. So it's neither necessary nor sufficient for solving sleep problems, though it can be nice. And for people who want to help themselves wake up in the mornings and become more of a morning person, you can use a bright light box. Those tend to be a little less expensive now that there are multiple different companies making them. And you do want the bright ones that have short wavelength light or broad spectrum light. I have one of those myself and I enjoy it very much, especially because I tend to be prone to a little seasonal affective disorder. But also you don't even have to get that fancy. You can go to a hardware store, get a broad spectrum light bulb that's at least 10,000 lux. And it doesn't have to be super exact, but something that mimics what it would be like, for example, on a overcast day outside, and don't have it right directly in front of your face. That's too much stimulation and hurts your eyes, but have it, you know, like arm's length away from you for about half an hour in the morning. That will do the exact same thing as one of these light boxes. So light during the day, very good. Light at night, try to keep it dim, but not a huge deal. And gadgets, depends on your budget.
Now, I have a question about wearables. I wonder if you could just let us know your thoughts on these wearables, because obviously, you know, in the sleep research field, when I did my research, we did full sleep studies where we put electrodes in the scalp and electrodes around the eye, and you know, we measured muscle tone, and it took a full hour to set up a sleep study. And there are lots of other limited sleep studies as well, which measure breathing, and you know, but which are very effective as well. But more recently, there have been so many sleep wearables that you can just buy and pop on, and it tells you exactly what you're doing. You have apps on your phone that tell you exactly the same thing. What are your thoughts on those? What are your thoughts on the sort of sleep wearables?
So I would answer that question as with two different hats on. So as a clinician versus as a researcher. So as a researcher, I'm really excited about these wearables. They're getting more and more accurate. They're getting better and better. They're providing just an unprecedented amount of data for us researchers to study and learn more about sleep. And it's wonderful because now we're getting a peek into long-term day-to-day sleep in patients' homes or in regular people's homes, which we just don't have the resources to do with traditional sleep measurements. So I'm very excited about that. And as a clinician, specifically as a clinician who mostly sees people with insomnia, I just have a little bit of hesitation sometimes. And that's because sometimes getting too wrapped up in those numbers from your wearables and getting too obsessed with those data can actually exacerbate the insomnia, make things worse, because this is similar to what we talked about earlier about sleep effort. It's like the more attention and the more time you invest into investigating your sleep, you're playing detective, you're playing engineer, you're trying to judge yourself, you're, you know, putting all this effort and time doing this mental calculus, tracking your sleep. It really might make sleep more of a project than it needs to be. And once it becomes a project and an engineering problem, then sleep is no longer your friend and you're going to have a problem with your relationship with sleep. So it's not an easy problem to answer because wearables are so common and available now. So people are going to use them. So I think maybe one good solution is for these wearable devices to provide more education along with tracking. Because sometimes I'll have a patient come in and say, I'm so desperate. My sleep is horrible. And I ask, how come? In what way is it horrible? And they say, well, my wearable tells me that I only get 20% deep sleep. That's so low. But as you know, 20% deep sleep is actually a pretty high percentage of deep sleep for a normal night. You don't have to have 100% deep sleep. You need all of the different stages. So I think along with the tracking, along with the data, if we could also educate people about what good sleep looks like, then that might ease some anxiety and help people to, you know, have a good relationship with sleep.
I think I just want to ask you a couple more questions before we end. There are so many herbal remedies and, you know, off the counter things that can help with your sleep. There are things like valerian root, and there are things like magnesium, and there are other sort of, you can just pick them up from a health food store. Is there much evidence?
there is not enough evidence to support them as being efficacious for treating insomnia. So for someone with insomnia, these supplements and herbal teas and whatnot are not going to be the answer to your insomnia. However, for regular people who don't have insomnia, who maybe just want a little bit of a boost, something like that might help. If they're low on magnesium, maybe taking some magnesium could help their overall health, and that could lead to better sleep. Or, you know, if they're iron deficient, taking some iron might help their overall health. So I guess the easiest way to answer that question is to say that none of these substances are the magic pill that will solve insomnia, and they're not going to significantly improve sleep more than better sleep behaviors or better sleep attitudes or better sleep knowledge would improve sleep.
Brilliant. Thank you. That's very good advice. I am going to end by asking you for your top five. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be five tips, but what are your sort of the top tips that you would give people who are having difficulty with sleeping?
My top several tips for people who have insomnia are, one, I would do some research into cognitive behavioral therapy. Even if you don't end up working with a clinician who specializes in this area, because to be honest, there's not that many of us, so there's not enough providers to go around. But if you even just read up on a little bit, it might shift your mindset about insomnia and set you on a good path to start with. And from there, you can look up other resources and books and podcasts and other information to help sort of piece some things together. So that's tip number one, is to look into cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. Tip number two is to practice listening to your body, because your body really does know best. I know it doesn't feel like that right now. Sometimes it might even feel like your body is betraying you, and that's a pretty tough and harsh way of relating to your body, but that might just be part of the problem, is that you and your body are not really in sync. You're not really having a good communication or good relationship. So you can start by just listening to what sleepiness feels like. So sometimes people are tired, but they're not sleepy. And let's make that tip number three, is to know the difference between sleepy and tired. You might be exhausted from a stressful long day at work, but you might not be sleepy yet. So at that point, if you go to bed, you're going to struggle to fall asleep, and you're going to feel like, how come I'm exhausted, but my mind is still racing? So at that point, don't go to bed, wait for sleepiness to actually come on. And that's when your eyes are droopy, you're nodding a little bit, you're, you know, like drowsy, you're maybe reading the same line in your book three times because you're starting to fade. That's what sleepiness is. And let's see, what else? I would get out of bed if you can't sleep. That is one of the more powerful things you can do to stop the vicious cycle and get yourself back onto more of a positive cycle. And I would say practicing mindfulness can help too. This just means getting in touch with your body and your surroundings, being in the here and now without judgment. So, you know, when you wake up in the night and it's 2 a.m. and you're so desperate and you're so frustrated, take a moment to just walk yourself through your body. What am I feeling in my body? Non-judgmentally. I'm not saying this is good or bad. Being awake is not good or bad. I'm simply experiencing wakefulness, and go from there. You know, just being more in touch and less judgmental of yourself can tone down some of that anxiety and that angst. And that tends to help a little bit too.
That is so powerful, Jade. Thank you. That's been extremely valuable. And I'm sure our listeners will really, you know, they'll love your advice. So thank you. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, sharing your knowledge, being so generous with your time. Really appreciate it. And, you know, if people want to find you, where can they find you? Where can they locate you?
Well, Zareen, thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a real pleasure, and I love chatting with you and sharing thoughts on insomnia. As you can tell, I can talk about this all day. And if you want to hear me talk about it all day, you can listen to my podcast, which is called The Savvy Psychologist. You can find it anywhere you listen to podcasts. It's not just about sleep, although I have a few episodes on that. It's also just about other aspects of psychology. And they're 10, 15 minute, pretty short episodes, just for fun, weekly episodes. And you can also find more information about me and more material that I write for the public on jadewuphd.com. And again, it was a pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, wonderful. That's excellent. We'll have links to all of that in the show notes. Thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciated it.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning in. And thank you to Dr. Jade Wu for joining us on this episode. If you want to hear more from Jade, you can find her podcast, Savvy Psychologist, on all of your favourite podcast platforms. If you have any suggestions, please just get in touch via the website freshheartproject.com. If you liked this episode, we would be so grateful if you could comment, subscribe, and give it a 5-star rating, as this helps us to spread our positive health messages. Our podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many more. If you're joining us on YouTube, then please hit the subscribe button and the bell to ensure that you get notifications for all of our video content. This podcast is not a substitute for medical advice from your healthcare professional. Remember, be kind to yourself, and small, sustainable steps create great change. This podcast is produced by Lion Mountain Entertainment, a subsidiary of Morgan Archway Limited.